You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 20th of March 2017 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Andrew Muller. On today's show,
I have been authorized by the Department of Justice to confirm that the FBI, as part of our counterintelligence mission, is investigating the Russian government's efforts to interfere in the 2016 presidential election.
The director of the FBI confirms that the feds are investigating connections between Donald Trump's presidential campaign and the Kremlin, and has been since last July, something he might usefully have mentioned at the time. My guests Elizabeth Brough and Stephen DL will be here to discuss that and the day's other top stories, including:
many nations owe vast sums of money from past years, and it is very unfair to the United States. These nations must pay what they owe.
President Trump's ongoing attempts to understand how NATO works, France's looming presidential debate, and a new name at the top of the UN's list of the world's happiest countries. Put the champagne on ice, Russia. That's all coming up on Midori House on Monocle 24 right now. So, welcome to Midori House. My guests today are Elizabeth Brough, non-resident senior fellow at the Atlantic Council, and Stephen DL, the Russia analyst. Welcome both. Now, it says much about the first 2 months of Donald Trump's term that the spectacle of the directors of the FBI and the NSA both testifying under oath that the president is either lying or fantasizing seems not at all surprising, and barely even weird. Nevertheless, this is what occurred today when James Comey and Mike Rogers appeared before the Congressional Intelligence Committee investigating links between Trump's campaign and Russia, and both men declined to support Trump's recent accusations that his residence had been bugged on the orders of his predecessor, Barack Obama. Now, to give us some understanding, or lack thereof, of the difficulties of discussing state secrets in a public setting, here is the representative for Ohio, Mike Turner, questioning James Comey earlier.
Mr. Comey, if you could help us on this issue, I would greatly appreciate it, because what happens is that you come into a classified briefing with us, and you tell us perhaps what something that is absolutely false. It really shouldn't be classified because you're telling us it's not true. But yet we can't go tell it's not true because you told us in a classified setting. Well, there's a way that we can at least have some exchange as to what's not true so that the American people don't listen to false stories in the Washington Post and the New York Times that we all know are not true. That would be helpful. If you could think about how you could help us with
that. I'd love to invent that machine, but we can't, because where do you stop that on that slope?
Well, false is false.
Because then, when I don't call the New York Times to say you got that one wrong, bingo, they got that one right. And so it's just an enormously complicated endeavor for us. We have to stay clear of it entirely.
Well, that's cleared everything up nicely, I think. Stephen, first of all, I don't even know where to start. No, we'll start with what I think is the big one, which is that we learned since the FBI have since last July been investigating dubious links between the Kremlin and the then campaign of the man who is now president of the United States. How far through the looking glass are we at this point?
Well, I feel like saying, well, I can't really tell you that because it's classified. It does seem to be how long is a piece of string. I mean, James Comey, you know, you can tell listening to some of the things he's saying that, you know, he's trying to be very careful. He's clearly, you know, he said, yes, an investigation is underway. But at this point, he can't give any indication of which way it's going. We can just make guesses. But it seems likely that if it's been going on this long and they haven't abandoned it yet, that there may be no smoke without fire. There may be some sort of evidence there. Of course, the White House and Sean Spicer, Trump's spokesman, has actually come out literally in the last few minutes and said, well, there you are. You see, it shows that there's no link between Trump and Russia. It doesn't show that at all. So it is smoke and mirrors. It's confused. But I would guess that somewhere down the line, someone is going to point a very big finger at Trump and say, you have got connections with Russia.
Elizabeth, smoke and mirrors, smoke without fire. What we don't appear to have yet is a smoking gun. Do we have any idea yet, at least, what one might look like? What would be the thing that would actually nail this story down?
It would be Melania Trump, who comes out and says, well, I'll tell you what's going on. and she'll do so because she's so fed up with not being taken seriously. And she has a lot of secrets to tell, even though being what we would consider a trophy wife, she probably hasn't sat in on as many meetings as Hillary did, as a political spouse and even Nancy Reagan. But no, seriously, I think when somebody from RT, for example, decides that this is just enough, somebody with a bit of an ethical mindset decides that enough is enough, that's, I think, the point where we will start getting secrets.
Stephen, a pet theory of mine, which I admit I have only developed in the last 30 to 45 seconds, so this may need a bit of road testing, but just thinking about what another thing Comey said today was that Russia, in its interference and its hacking and its general shenanigans, he said, had been very loud and as if they didn't care if we found out. Now, is it possible, I think I can see where I'm going this, that what we're looking at here is not actually interference as such, but a sort of meta-interference, which is why there might not be a smoking gun, i.e. that Russia didn't really interfere with the election, but greatly enjoys creating the impression that it did.
It's possible, but I think unlikely. I think we will find that there was interference. One reason why it's possible is because one of the things we've seen with Russian disinformation generally, not just with America, but with Europe and each European country being individually targeted now, is they will throw out all sorts of stories. There doesn't even have to be an element of truth in it. One of the, I was going to say best, but probably a better word is worst examples, of course, was the shooting down of MH17, the Dutch airliner that was shot down over Ukraine in
Malaysian
July.
Malaysian airliner flying from the Netherlands.
Yeah, from the Netherlands. In July 2014, the initial reaction was, yes, great, we've shot down the plane. And then they realized it wasn't actually a Ukrainian transport plane. They tried to delete the tweets. 4 days later, Russia starts to come out with all sorts of nonsense. I mean, saying that an Su-25 of the Ukrainian Air Force shot it down when an Su-25 can't fly at that height, it would break up. Another version said, oh, no, it was a bomb on board, as the damage shows. The damage showed exactly the opposite. They put out all these completely nonsensical versions and to flood the information space so that people end up thinking, well, we don't know what to believe. They don't care if they're found out. They don't care if someone turns around and says, oh, yes, look, there is, you know, maybe there is an actual connection. They just don't care. But then also there is this, you know, the dossier that was apparently leaked towards the end of last year, saying, be they sexual, be they financial shenanigans that Trump got up to. Again, my feeling is that there may have been a serious basis to that, and they may well have something. They will have thrown the net wide on foreigners visiting Russia, and they have, forgive the pun, perhaps come up trumps.
I completely agree with that, that their strategy is to muddy the waters. And if you look at, for example, the submarine hunt in Sweden or off the Swedish coast, they did exactly the same thing. So when the Swedes didn't find anything, you could hear, you could read Russia Today's tweet suggesting that maybe it wasn't the submarine after all. Maybe it was just an animal, and the hopeless Swedish Navy doesn't know how to tell a submarine trail from something else. And just throwing all these theories out there with the goal of making citizens in that country distrust the authorities. And so it doesn't matter. All that matters is this muddying of the waters. And by the way, that doesn't just happen in the information sphere. It happens in the military sphere as well, where, for example, they stage almost daily near incursions in over Baltic airspace. So 110 incursions, near incursions last year that warranted NATO aircraft to respond. Well, then every time you have to guess, well, what are they up to? Is this the real thing? Are they just teasing us? And it's a constant stream of provocations.
It is. And you've had, for example, with the small deployment of NATO troops to the three Baltic states and Poland, you've already had, just after the Germans arrived, a false accusation about German soldiers raping a teenage girl. this is a repeat of a lie they told last year in Germany. They said that a group of immigrants had raped a 13-year-old girl of Russian origin in Berlin. It was complete nonsense. There was no attack. There was nothing at all. But it really stirred it up. You even had the foreign minister, Lavrov, involved. So that they are playing, I hesitate to call it a game even, they are carrying out these sort of operations constantly. And so if they get found out, they really don't care. They just move on to something else.
Well, let's move along to the next subject, because that takes us into it nicely. And while the precise scale and nature of Donald Trump's affinity for Russia remains to be determined, his outreach to the countries which previously thought of themselves as American allies is proceeding uncertainly. Trump's recent and inaccurate claim that Germany owes NATO and the US vast sums of money has played predictably badly in Berlin, with Defence Minister Ursula von der Leyen treating Trump to a brisk explanation of how NATO funding works, a chorus joined online by Ivo Dalda, former US permanent representative to NATO. Elizabeth, it's always the big question where Trump is concerned as to whether what he says is an accurate reflection of the contents of his head or whether he is just pretending that not to understand. But anyway, what is your sense? Does he genuinely not understand how NATO actually works, or is he just pretending not to? And I'm not even sure which of those is worse, coming from the President of the United States.
I think he genuinely doesn't understand how NATO works. And what's even worse is that he doesn't want to understand. He is very happy never reading any books, as he told his biographer who wrote the book, that the one book that he has read, apparently, which is the book that he also co-wrote with
he is one of those rare people who may actually have written more books than he's read.
That's right. They are very rare indeed. But he doesn't want to understand. And clearly nobody in the White House or the Pentagon has dared to explain to him how NATO funding works, which is that the amount of money that each member pays to NATO is very little, because it's not a large organization. It's just the headquarters and some stuff. What he's referring to is what each country spends on defense, and that's where Germany, I mean, it doesn't spend the 2%.
This is the 2% guideline.
That's right. But I think what's really dangerous about this is his suggestion that Germany should pay the Americans for having provided security. But if you go down that route, it's a transactional view relationships, international relationships. So I help you, but you pay me for it. It's like the US becomes some sort of mercenary corps in the end. So imagine World War II. So would half of Europe then have to pay?
Well, it was quite recently, I think, that the UK finished repaying the Lend-Lease loan to the United States, relatively. I mean, the US didn't give all that stuff away. I mean,
it didn't send a bill for saying, you know, this is for World War II, now you pay.
And it's not the way NATO is run.
That's right.
And it isn't the way NATO is run.
No, I mean, part of it was, okay, yeah, there was that aspect to it. But it's not as if, you know, if you don't pay, we're not going to help you.
Stephen, does Trump, speaking for the United States, have half a point here, though? Because the thing, it is an unarguable fact, one of the few he's able to deploy, correctly at least, that most of the NATO alliance do not meet the 2% threshold. It's only the United States, the UK, and if I think I've got this right, Poland, Estonia, and Greece, though Greece may only just fall over the line because, of course, their economy has actually tanked in the last few years and 2% of the Greek GDP is not what it once was. But does America, not just Trump, but does America have grounds for complaint? Fundamentally, has the rest of NATO been taking a free ride?
No, in a word. Yes, perhaps certain NATO members could pay more, but the Americans, for example, always have the Supreme Allied Commander Europe. That's mm-hmm. always an American. So they are always militarily at the head of the organization. They know also that it's in their best interest to defend Europe because, particularly nowadays, you know, a war would become, we've already had two world wars, this would certainly be, if there were war in Europe, it would become a world war, there's no doubt about it. And so it's actually forward defence for them. They are the biggest country in the alliance. That brings with it certain obligations. So yes, they can behind the scenes try and encourage countries to pay a little bit more. But I don't think they can have any complaints. But this idea that it's as Elizabeth said, it's run on a transactional basis. This is not business, and this does show that Trump does not have a grasp of politics and what it means to be president. Another, generally doesn't understand how NATO is run and how it's funded. Another example was healthcare. There was a wonderful little piece on Twitter a couple of weeks ago showing him saying, nobody understands how complicated healthcare is. And it was followed by a whole series of clips of Obama saying, now you need to understand, healthcare is really complicated. Healthcare, yes, it's complicated. But Trump had suddenly, he's like a child. He's like a child who's just discovered something for himself and therefore assumes that no one else knows about it. Hey, and listen, I'm going to tell you that this is how it is.
Are you pursuing a second career over here, Steve?
Well, maybe someone out there could hear me. I quite fancy being an actor.
What's more about the 2% spending? It's a very, very blunt tool. Just because a country spends 2% on defense doesn't mean that it's a better or more dedicated member or ally in NATO. For example, look at Greece, which you just mentioned. They used to spend 6% on defense. Now it's down to 3.5%. But it doesn't benefit NATO at all because it spends all this money on defense just to compete with Turkey and buys useless equipment, which then can't use because it's out of money. It doesn't benefit in any NATO in any way. So it's a really blunt tool to be throwing around at committed NATO members. And by the way, Obama and other previous presidents have politely asked NATO members, NATO allies, to spend more. So it's not as if just because Trump just discovered it, it's not as if nobody else knows about it.
Final thought on this one from you, Elizabeth. Are you reassured at all that the rest of Trump's administration, from Vice President Pence downwards, have been punctilious in saying all the correct, which is to say orthodox, things about NATO and how important it is, American commitment to it, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera?
Yes, I have. And I think it's clear at this point that if were it not for the generals, the U.S. administration would be in very big trouble. So, thank God for the generals. And I think as long as Mattis, Secretary Mattis, is there, we are reasonably safe. And Trump can tweet all he wants, but I think Mattis will keep him in.
On that semi-optimistic note, we will take a short break. You're listening to Midori House here with me, Andrew Muller, along with Elizabeth Brough and Stephen Deal. Coming up next, it's presidential debate night in France.
How much information can you pack into a minute? Every morning, the Monocle Minute wings its way into your inbox, packed with the very latest news and views from around the world, all delivered with a monocle twist. We'll tell you what that new aircraft carrier means for Southeast Asia, why the next EU summit will be more interesting than normal, and what to look out for at an upcoming election. We'll pick out the latest retail trend in Latin America, analyse the aviation news in Australia, and take a tour of a neighbourhood that's on the up. And there's more. At the weekend, we'll review the best new restaurants, give you the lowdown on that art exhibition you've been meaning to visit, and dissect the best of the latest fashion week. See? There's rather a lot you can pack into a minute. Sign up now at monocle.com/minute.
You are back with Midori House, with me, Andrew Muller. Still with me are Elizabeth Brough and Stephen Deal. Now, it's just over 4 weeks until French voters go to the polls in the first round of their presidential election, with a decisive top two runoff to follow a fortnight following that. The five frontrunners will tonight meet in a live televised debate, expected to consume 2.5 hours of prime time. They are En Marche's Emmanuel Macron, the Front National's Marine Le Pen, Les Républicains' François Fillon, and the Socialist Benoît Hamon and Jean-Luc Mélenchon of La France Insoumise. Apologies to all French listeners for all the preceding pronunciation. Stephen, it's a five-way debate. I mean, this isn't quite the chimpanzee tea party we saw during the Republican primaries, but it's getting there. Is there anything anybody can actually usefully or constructively say in such an environment?
I would doubt it. I'm sure there will be a lot of Gallic shrugs and blowing out of cheeks, as the French often do, and much disagreement between them, of course. But I would doubt that your average French voter is going to come away having watched this and say, "Sacre bleu, I will vote for him or her."
Elizabeth, who do you imagine are the people whose minds are as yet unmade up in France? And is five people yelling at each other on a stage for 2 hours going to sway anybody one way or the other?
I doubt it. And I would go even further. I think televised presidential debates or political debates are a scourge. because they don't add anything, and what they add is that the most telegenic guy comes away with the best result. I mean, just look at Nick Clegg, if you remember his moment.
I remember Clegg mania in 2010, or I'm reliably informed that inside the Liberal Democrats' office, it was known as Clegg's to see was the official name,
but. These televised debates, as you said, they don't really help anybody make their minds up. It's a repetition of slogans. And in a five-way race, how are you going to make any sort of substantial arguments? This is democracy. In a multi-party race, you have to invite more than two people. But I doubt that there will be any political breakthrough that will help anybody, any voters, or help any voters make their minds up.
But even so, it's 5 out of 11. So you know you've got six others left out, well, they may come in for the second round.
They are threatening to have all 11 on stage for a future debate. But Stephen, are there opportunities here for any of this fivesome? Thinking specifically of Francois Fillon, who really is at this point in surely the let's have a crack at something, nothing to lose part of his campaign at this stage.
I'm sure, yeah, I mean, he is, of course, and I'm sure he will be thinking, well, if I can, and as Elizabeth said, if I can look good on telly, then, you know, perhaps I can win a few people over. But, I mean, that's so empty, isn't it? I mean, you know, just because I look good, you know, he's got such a row going on behind him about, you know, whether he paid his wife or not and whether she worked or not.
Among others.
I don't know. I mean, to my mind, it's a sign of the times more of how, you know, we are driven by social media. Television is actually less popular these days in some ways, but it's still how it looks. You know, it's not really the substance; it's just the appearance on the surface. And I'm sure, actually, of them all, I mean, I would have thought Marine Le Pen is probably licking her lips, and you know, she is. If nothing else, you know, she is very good at speaking out, and I'm sure she will use every opportunity she gets in this debate to try and stick a few knives in her opponents.
But then again, you can ask how important televised debates are. If you look at Trump versus Hillary, those debates where Hillary just won hands down, and apparently it didn't affect Trump at all, because he could then go out and tweet and complain about her. So maybe as popular or as widespread as televised televised political debates are, maybe their time is over, because candidates communicate directly with their voters and potential voters.
Or maybe, as you say, that maybe actually the really interesting thing will be the Twitter storm that follows, either from the candidates or from their supporters. I'm sure they've got them lined up to send lots of messages saying, wasn't our candidate good?
And that reminds me of what Trump was doing during the hearing just now, that we talked about just now. Which is apparently, he was watching it on television and tweeting about it as it was happening. And if I may just mention, there is a fantastic profile of the White House press corps in the current issue of The New Yorker. And among the many interesting things that the journalist mentions is that there are very few events on Trump's schedule during the hour that Sean Spicer briefs the press every day. And there are also mysterious messages that are handed to Spicer regularly during that hour. So somebody is watching in another part of the White House.
Well, we'll move along finally tonight to Denmark, which is officially no longer the world's happiest nation, according to the UN Sustainable Development Solutions Network's World Happiness Report 2017. Try saying that three times quickly. In a detail which may see Denmark shunted down a further few notches next year, such are inter-Scandinavian rivalries, they have been tipped out of top spot by their neighbours in Norway. Rounding out the top five were Iceland, Switzerland and Finland. So we've learnt that weather isn't a criteria, I think, Stephen. What is? Why are these nations happy nations?
Well, from my own experience of Norway, I think it's a wonderful country.
I'm a big fan of Norway.
There's clean air, there's wonderful scenery.
Nothing not to like.
Well, indeed, and the people. I mean, I've been a few times to Norway, and I'm always happy to go back because I have always found, and I don't speak Norwegian, and I sort of say to people, excuse me, do you speak English? Everyone seems to speak English. Everyone, it just seems so polite, friendly. There's a wonderful, relaxed atmosphere. I mean, Oslo, I think, is a fantastic city. Bergen, I've been into. I've been on the fjords. Yeah, as you say, it's interesting. I should say I've only been there in the summer, so I haven't seen a Norwegian winter, although I don't mind the cold, but it's the dark that tends to get people in the winter. But despite that, yes, they come out on top, and Denmark second, Iceland too, Iceland in third place. You know, another country that gets very dark in the winter.
It gets incredibly dark in the winter. I was there in December a few years ago. It's like it's dark except for between about 11 in the morning and 3 in the afternoon. I mean, genuinely, it's quite odd. I mean, Elizabeth, surveys like this, and there are many of them. Monocle runs one itself, of course, the world's most livable city. Although Tokyo is our current reigning 2-time champion. But that aside, our survey is no different in that there's always a big focus on Scandinavia and Northern Europe and the Antipodes. And in this UN report, New Zealand and Australia are 8th and 9th. And I can say, speaking for my Australian country folk, that's going to go over incredibly badly, being one place behind New Zealand. But nonetheless, is this just saying that happiness is stability?
Well,
because these are all incredibly stable, well-run, well-governed countries.
So happiness, according to this survey, is caring, freedom, generosity, honesty, health, income, and good governance, which are elements that you get in abundance in Scandinavia, and I can say that being Scandinavian myself. But what the survey didn't do was talk to actual people. They measured all these elements of a well-functioning country, but they actually haven't asked any Norwegians whether they are happy, and and neither have they asked anybody in South Sudan, Liberia, Guinea, Togo, Rwanda, Tanzania, Burundi, and the Central African Republic whether they are happy. And I would argue that if you actually ask them, they would, many of them would consider themselves happy because they have friends. They may not have good governance and high incomes, but they have family networks, maybe, or other elements that make them happy.
Because there is a weird paradox there, which I've never satisfactorily accounted for in my head, and which is very difficult to discuss without sounding like you're being extraordinarily patronising. But I have noticed a thing where I have been to countries which are broke and broken down and shambolic, and the people generally seem quite often more cheerful, certainly more generous and hospitable than you would find in an orderly and wealthy country. Like I said, you can get into a weird area real fast talking about this, but it is a thing.
Yes, I mean, that is a very good point. I mean, there are certain ones. You know, number 152 on the list out of 155 is Syria. I think we can probably all agree that that's not a happy country.
I wouldn't have said so right now, no.
And Yemen at 146. Yeah, I think, you know, this is very much a first world sort of top 10 for happiness. You know, what does happiness mean? Actually, we haven't got time, unfortunately, for a long philosophical discussion, but Elizabeth's point is very good. You know, what is happiness? I think, actually, if you stop and think about it, having a good family, having friends around you, having security, which, of course, maybe some of the poorer countries don't have. But those are things that actually are more important than the other things we've discussed.
Well, on that philosophical note, that is all we have time for on today's Midori House. Thank you to Stephen DL and Elizabeth Braw. Today's show was produced by Tom Hall, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Helena Jarit. Our studio manager was Toby Hammond. Music next at 1900, it's Culture with Rob Bound. We'll have more on the day's stories on the Daily at 2200. Midori House returns at the same time tomorrow, 1800 London time. For now, I'm Andrew Muller. Thanks for listening. Goodbye.